Welcome to another episode of Inside Ivy Hoops. Mike Tony, editor of Ivy Hoops Online, joined by IHO writer extraordinaire Rob Brown. Rob, how are you?
I am really well, doing well, thanks, Mike. You know, I feel like in the spirit of everything going on in DC, we should have probably invited Robin Harris on, and we could have had people send in questions on index cards and had her read them out for you and I to answer tonight.
Yeah, we might just have gotten as many as John Roberts has had to field in the Senate, on the Senate floor there. Yeah, lot to process since just last week's podcast. First and foremost, on the minds of so many, not just around the Ivy Hoops world, but the world of basketball, just the world in general. The death of Kobe Bryant, his sudden death following a helicopter crash that killed his 13-year-old daughter Gianna and seven others near Los Angeles Sunday, really put into perspective just how much Kobe Bryant mattered to Ivy League hoopsters, past and present. Mia Oney, it was announced today, is changing his jersey number to honor Bryant with the Salt Lake City Stars. He will now wear number 81. He posted on Twitter earlier today, 8 equals new beginnings, 1 equals unity. Of course, 81, the number of points that Bryant scored in his 2006 game, the second most any NBA player scored in a game in league history, of course, behind only Wilt Chamberlain's 100. Seth Towns's remembrance on Twitter stood out. Seth Towns remembering him walking miles through storms from his house to the YMCA. Being inspired by Kobe Bryant to, you know, pursue his passion, falling asleep to his YouTube highlight tapes playing on his phone screen. A lot of appreciation, certainly from the Ivy Hoops world. You know, of course, you do have to be careful not to worship people just because you happen to be inspired by what they do in their line of work, whether it be sports or art or politics, whatever. You know, of course, though, there's nothing wrong with showing appreciation that a person who you've never met inspired you to strive to be better at something, you know, to be a more dedicated, more caring, hopefully more empathetic person. And I think that's what I've seen from most people reflecting on what Kobe Bryant meant to them in a very difficult time. And that's good on the whole. Rob, do you have any thoughts on any of this?
It was a gut punch on Sunday. I had come home, one of my sons had told me about it, and you know, I'm old enough to remember too many of these kind of things, but to non-celebrities and celebrities, you know, you think back to recent things like Jose Fernandez, Tyler Skaggs, but you know, those had different circumstances around them. But you know, then you start thinking back of Pelly Lindbergh, the Flyers goaltender who had a car crash and passed away suddenly. And I think he was 25, but there was Dragan Petrovic of the New Jersey Nets back in 1993. And for those of us old enough to remember, the most common thing in, you would think is Thurman Munson, the Yankees catcher, the captain, who was working on he was a pilot, and he was working on takeoff and landing on an off day and crashed and died suddenly. Those were the things that just, you know, popped into my head over time. And obviously the incredible tragedy of all nine people, and Kobe and his daughter, his 13-year-old daughter, and the other young woman in the helicopter. So it's just soul-crushing, and it puts things in perspective, obviously. And then as the time moves on, and you realize, like, as you said, what he meant to a lot of people. Incredible basketball talent, one of the greatest ever. A work ethic, a competitiveness that's almost unrivaled in NBA history. And then as he got older, you could see the mentorship of not only people in the NBA, but of younger athletes and non-athletes. Just seeing how many people have written that he reached out to, text, phone calls, really incredible. And you saw that he also kind of branched out. He won an Oscar in 2018, an animated short based on his retirement speech. I think he was involved in the literary world as well. So he really was moving in a different direction. Plus, he was also, growing into an incredible advocate for women's basketball from youth level through the NBA. Maybe inspired by his daughter's interest, maybe not, but he touched a lot of people. And I think your point about deifying people is really, really an important part of this. For all of the incredible positives with Kobe, there is a really chillingly dark part of his life back in 2003 and 2004, from an allegation of rape in a hotel in Colorado. If I can read the accounts, it's the Daily Beast, I believe, has from an article in 2016 goes through the police reports, and it's kind of rough and brutal, and what he and his legal team did to the survivor of that incident. She eventually withdrew cooperating, so they never went to a criminal trial, but Kobe did issue an apology for his behavior, and eventually there was a civil case that was settled out of court. And I know there are people who think that it's too soon to talk about those things. I'm not one of them, but I know a lot of people feel that way. And I would just say for all of the fans out there, I would say for people on all sides of the issue, make sure you judge the whole of a person fairly. I would say make sure you go and you see the positives and the less positives about Kobe Bryant. And read up, see what's out there, and then ultimately you make your own decision of where you come down on everything. If I could give one recommendation to listeners, there was a podcast on Slate. They have a sports podcast called Hang Up and Listen, and they had an hour-long tribute conversation about Kobe Bryant. And the last half hour talked about the positives and negatives, where how do you put things in perspective, and it was... Josh Levin is one of the hosts, and Stefan Fatsis, who actually is a Penn grad from '85 and a writer, former writer for the Daily Pennsylvanian. And they had a conversation with Lindsay Gibbs, who's a journalist who has a newsletter on that. I thought it was really powerful. That part was about 30 minutes, but the whole hour was really worth people's listen.
Yeah, well, think for yourself is kind of my takeaway, Rob, from what you've said, and that's a good, I think that's a good mantra for anyone, really. Stefan Fatsis, as someone who wrote for the Daily Pennsylvanian and runs a Scrabble club, I appreciate what he does. Have long appreciated what he does for sure. This is an Ivy Hoops podcast, and there's a big ticket item that we must get to. The big scheduling news, of course. The Ivy League announced this week it will be changing its conference scheduling for the next two seasons. To recap, it'll be a 10-week schedule, all 16 teams beginning conference play January 2nd, 2021. There will be only three of the league's patented back-to-back weekends, and each Ivy's regular season will end with a single game travel partner matchup. This all coincides with Princeton's fall semester exams moving from January to December, starting with the 2020-2021 academic year, something that was long awaited. plus, there will be 6-1 opponent weekends. Each team will have a contest on Martin Luther King Junior Day. What did you find out, Bob, this week from the league office in addition to what the league announced earlier this week?
I mean, not a heck of a lot. You know, I mean, I think the main thing is I was curious on those Friday, on those single game weekends, were they going to be all the same day? Were they going to be, well, could they be any time? Could they be Friday? Could be that? Could they be Saturday? Could they be Sunday? You know, we certainly see it already this season where Yale and Brown have played on a Friday night. Some other teams have played on a Saturday. So the league said that all the single weekend games will be on Saturday. Doesn't necessarily mean they're all Saturday night, but they all will be on Saturday, weather permitting.
So I think this is a situation in which what's best for the fans isn't necessarily what's best for the players, who I think have to come first in any scheduling consideration. I mean, from a fan's perspective, what for so long made the Ivy League unique was that it consisted of a 14-game tournament consisting of, in itself, back-to-backs that could really be entertaining. Now, both of those signature pillars of the league's identity as of next season will be either greatly diminished or gone. We're going to be running on the site some reactions to this from our staff. One of our contributors, the great Ray Curran, wrote something that I agree 100% with, trying to see if Yale or Harvard could back up a Friday night win on the Upper West Side with a gutsy victory in Ithaca 24 hours later is just something you don't get from any other conference, and I will miss it on the weekends. It doesn't exist anymore. I mean, I agree with that. You know, you're playing most of the one-game weekend on Saturdays instead of Fridays, which I've already seen fans complain about on Twitter, saying the quality of the officiating will be worse on Saturdays as it's typically been, or at least been perceived to have been in the past. And I think it also runs the risk of making the league season just feel longer for fans, in particular fans of Columbia, Cornell, Brown, and Yale, because those teams typically have started a bit later. But the benefits to players and coaches are obvious. You know, cutting back on grueling road trips, you know, really, there's still going to be travel involved, and it's going to be actually, at least theoretically, stretched out. The concept is stretching it out for more weeks now. So it's not as if, you know, you're greatly cutting on back on travel. Obviously you're not cutting back at all. But what you're doing is you're switching it around to try to make things easier, ideally on the players. And I have heard horror stories from players and alums about, you know, having to try to study on the bus or, hard to sleep, hard to function. it's hard to squeeze in two intense nights of basketball repeatedly throughout a season. on the road. And so, you know, I can see wanting to try to lessen that head. And if that is ultimately the upshot of this, the people who are actually in the arena doing it, then I think that's bottom line, even if fans may have some reason to have pause over this. What's your take, Rob?
Yeah, first I'll take a step back about the information from the league office. The only change on that Saturday for the single game, they said, would be not only weather, but also, you know, the ESPN overlords, if they wanted to put one of the games on the linear network.
And that could happen. That could very well happen. Yeah.
Absolutely. And then the other question I had for them was on that last travel partner day, would they be doing things like the Premier League or the MLS where, you know, everybody's playing at the exact same time? And they said that's not necessarily, you know, that's not something they're going to be controlling. That's for the individual teams to decide when they want to play. With regards to the schedule change, I guess, you know, as I commented to you during the week, after listening to a lot of the interviews you did last year on the podcast with various coaches and assistant coaches, I was worried I kind of thought they would move to a Friday, Sunday. I don't know if anyone said that or it's just the way I interpreted, but I kind of thought that would be a big negative if they moved the games to Sunday afternoon. I thought it would be tougher viewership. I think attendance would take an even tougher hit on that. So I'm kind of looking at the positives. I kind of like the idea that they've kept, you know, the back-to-backs, you know, certainly the Saturday MLK day. I'm fine with that as well. The single games, you know, yeah, if the players want that, you know, and the coaches, that's fantastic. I know that when you graduate and you get older, you put a romantic view on those back-to-back weekends and the studying issues and the travel. But I think when you're going through it, it's really hard. So I really appreciate that they've taken some feedback from the students. I do like that they're starting up in January, in early January. You know, how many times have we talked over the last couple of weeks where it's, hey, they're not playing for a couple of weeks, and hey, they've got a D3 game, and hey, they found like a team from the, you know, from a lower ranked conference to squeeze in there. So I'm really kind of glad that they're filling up that void. I also like the fact that everybody's playing at the same time, so it's not Penn and Princeton by themselves, and then you've got Harvard, Dartmouth, and you know, maybe Cornell, Columbia. So instead of having that kind of like scattered system over the first 3 weeks, you know, we're all going to get everybody playing at the same time. I think it levels the playing field. I also like that we're getting rid of that back-to-back travel partner weekends. They're frustrating as a fan. I can only imagine from a coaching and player standpoint that it must be really tough to play a game and then turn right around and face the same team again. So I think the positives outweigh the negatives. You know, I'm curious, as I think I noted to you, you know, I'm curious to see how it all plays out. Do we see a difference in the quality of the games and the officiating on the single game weekend, the back-to-backs, the Saturday, Monday? You know, that's going to be some interesting stuff over the next 2 years. But overall, I think I'm pleased and relieved. That's probably my takeaway from it all. How about you, ultimately?
I don't know. I mean, I still have a little bit of trepidation. We'll see how it goes. I'm not as averse to this as I was the Ivy League tournament. I'll put it that way. Where I come from on this is, I think if I were a player, I think I would probably welcome it. To at least see how it goes, if it's better for me academically, if it's better for me as a student who's juggling 18 billion things. So with that in mind, I think it's worth a try. As a fan, I don't like it on the whole, for the reasons I described. Although I will say that I agree 100% that eliminating the back-to-backs with the travel partners to open up conference play is a huge, huge positive. I mean, that just also just from a competitive standpoint, you know, you're playing a team twice in one small window of the season, where maybe you have a player that's injured both times, and you know, and we've seen that, and you know, that's the matchup you get for that entire season. You don't get another crack at that team unless you do happen to meet them in the conference tournament. It just makes sense to me to start and particularly end the season playing your travel partner, not get the travel partner out of the way anticlimactically, you know, to begin the season. You know, I don't, when you're when you have the unique facets of play that the Ivy League has had, you know, having the intensity of a 14-game tournament, having the sometimes playing field evening, you know, always gritty back-to-backs that we've seen, the signature back-to-back weekends, you know, it makes sense from a branding perspective to try to hang on to those things, which clearly the league is getting away from strategically. But you know, we'll see. I mean, I guess that's kind of where I stand on it. I think what's more important, it's more important to accommodate student athletes and the coaches than it is the fans. Because we're just fans. We're going about our daily lives. We, you know, these are the people that are actually in the arena. It's supposed to be about the students first. So, you know, whatever we think as fans, honestly, I think you cast that aside. Now, if the players don't like this, then that's a reason to drop it. But I don't think that's the case. So we'll see how it goes. You know, from a scheduling perspective, you know, for example, Penn's going to play all of its Big Five games before the start of the calendar year, the 2021 calendar year. Daily Pennsylvania noted, you know, it'll be a bit of a scheduling challenge for everybody to try to cram some more stuff in December. But, you know, you don't have that scheduling dead zone that you referenced in January when you're stacking D3 games and maybe accumulating a bit of rust going into your travel partner games, which, again, made those travel partner games worse in addition to, you know, students not even being back from break yet, in some cases. So, yeah, that part of it is definitely worth it, and the rest could potentially be too. You know, we'll see. It was definitely something that was going to be tried. It could very well be worth a try, and we'll see.
At least it's a 2-year experiment versus the Ivy tournament. What is it, an experiment? So, you know, that seems like a better
situation. Yes, that's a good point. Yeah, we didn't, you know, nobody signed up for this, you know, well into this decade. So, that's an excellent point. The news this week that Ivy League lacrosse is doing a little bit doing things a little bit differently. Rob, what's your uh, what's your take on the comparison there, and how the lacrosse, Ivy lacrosse world is going about this differently?
Yeah, so for those that don't know, if you look at like last year's Ivy tournament, they have the same setup: four teams in the men's division, four teams in the women's division play for the bid to the NCAA tournament, the automatic bid. Last year, there's seven of the eight teams that have a lacrosse program. Columbia being the only one that doesn't field teams. So what they would do is they had the tournament at Columbia, both the men and the women at the same time. So I can't remember if it was the exact same days, but it's certainly the same weekend. So it was at a neutral site conference venue. What they did for this year is they're going to move the men. Hofstra University, a non-conference venue. The women's division is going to go to the format of the semifinals will be at the higher seed, the number one and two seeds, and then the final will be 2 days later at the higher seed. So now you have a situation where you've broken apart the two tournaments, and one of them is at a neutral site, and the other is at the higher seed. These were all concerns that people had with basketball over the last couple. Venue. Why can't the women have their own division, their own tournament? Why can't we play it at the higher seed? I remember Courtney Bangart, former Princeton coach, was certainly not pleased when she was the number one seed playing number two Penn at the Palestra. The league went out of their way to keep getting everybody on the same page, buying into having the tournament at the same location, and then moving it, you know, keeping it on campus sites. And if you're Harvard, the Harvard men, you've now played in the number one seed 2 years in a row. You've played at Penn and at Yale and lost both times. So it's interesting. When I reached out to the conference, they said, well, this is what the coaches wanted. Well, you know, that didn't seem to be the final answer when we talked about basketball, because you certainly have interviewed people over the years that voiced questions and concerns. I think Megan Griffin wanted all eight teams in a women's tournament. Brian Earle wanted to play at St. John's and be in the New York area. Many people obviously wanted the Palestra. So it's just funny how there's this hypocritical decision-making going on. So it's sort of like, did ESPN have something to say in all of this? The league always says no to that, but I don't know the truth. You know, it just seems like we're getting spins from the two different sports. And so I can't understand why you can have it at one and you can't have it at the other. So, I think that eight-year experiment looks a little awkward as time goes on and you see what's now going on with the lacrosse tournaments.
I'm glad you didn't let me forget about that, Rob, because that is there. It is a curious disconnect between what's going on with basketball, you know, what the outcome is and what the future is that the league has you know, locked into, and you know, what the rationale was given for these latest moves on the lacrosse end of things. I don't really know what to make of it either. But there is definitely a curious disconnect there that makes signing up for this rotation on the basketball side all the more curious. It just seems to, on the basketball end of things, that, the league is trying to signal and indeed work toward middle ground. But things do seem to be half measures to a certain extent. You know, you're having a conference tournament that signals that you might even the playing field a bit. But then you hold the tournament at predetermined Ivy home sites. You're saying that back to backs are not, they're not necessarily a good thing to lean into, but you keep three of them instead of six. So, you know, through a critical lens, certainly, you know, you can see these moves as half measures that, you know, are seeking middle ground amid experimentation, but wind up as just middling to some Ivy followers. So that's a good point, Ra. I'm glad you brought up that interesting comparison. I have to try to recap quickly what was an interesting weekend of action on both sides. Start with the men. Yale completed yet another season sweep of Brown, 73-62 in Providence. Impressive performance by the Bulldogs. Penn got right in Big Five play to wrap up things against a Temple team that isn't a very good shooting team, and Penn took advantage of that in a 66-59 win at the Palestra with Fran Dunphy on hand for in front of both of his former teams. Cornell taking care of business, winning a Division I game for the first time in nearly 3 months since the season opener against Binghamton, shutting Columbia down in a 62-50 win up in Ithaca. Harvard hanging on in really a deja vu from its previous win against Dartmouth for a sweep of the Big Green in Hanover. Any takeaways, Rob, from any of those games on the men's side?
You know, just Yale being Yale, you know, they're rolling out. They've got everything. They just seem to be firing on all cylinders, right? So that, what is it, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5? I don't know, 11 games out of 12 for Yale. They're just really rolling. You know, Columbia, Cornell, that's going to be the kind of game that Columbia is going to really regret down the road. The chances are not strong for them making the Ivy tournament, and starting off 2-0 against Cornell would have really seemed doable and the best case scenario for them. And they just came out so flat. Jack Forrest got two quick fouls. Really couldn't get in sync all day. Mike Smith put up a lot of points, but struggled. Low shooting percentage. Cornell, to their credit, it was really sloppy first half, but they came out firing in the second. You know, definitely good defensive effort, good offensive. You know, I think Brian Earle always seems to find a way to exceed expectations in the conference. So that may be something we should keep an eye out for. Let's see, Harvard, Dartmouth. Boy, you know, Bryce Aiken, again, it's a roller coaster of Bryce Aiken. He was supposed to play. Everyone thought he was going to play. He'd been practicing all week. And I think back in the ankle boot, and the Harvard Crimson, Henry Zapp, tweeted out that there really is no timetable for his return. So that's another big mystery. But they played well, really well, but then on the road, had control of that game, but the second time against Dartmouth, they could not hold it late and let the Big Green back in. That's something they're going to have to tighten up. I think they've won 7 of 8, and that's a really, you know, great mark for them. But they've got to get late game stability, and that's something that Bryce Aiken certainly provides. Penn, a big win. I think they really needed that. Things have been going really poorly in the month of January. It seems like Steve Donahue, for the moment, is just going seniors and freshmen. So you've got a lot of experience, a lot of inexperience. Jordan Dingle seemed to get back in sync, which is a real big positive. They brought Max Martz into the fold, playing the four spot. his three-point shooting has declined a lot this month, but it seems like he's been focusing more on the defensive side. So we'll see how that plays in going forward, especially this weekend. I think everybody's set. We'll see. It is what it is. I guess we have, three teams now at 2-0, two teams at 1-1, Cornell and Columbia, and then what does that leave us with? Three teams at 0-2, Penn, Dartmouth, and Brown. So, that's where we're set heading into this weekend.
And on the women's side, last weekend, well, on Thursday, I don't think that quite qualifies as the weekend. Temple turning Penn back in a Big Five matchup in which Alea Parker had a very strong performance. Double-double. Kea Padilla didn't make it into double figures. Palestra Pete pointed out he's been doing a terrific job.
Absolutely.
Love his work on the site for sure. He pointed out that if you could just get Padilla and Parker firing on all cylinders at once, Penn will be harder to beat than it already is. In Saturday action, Yale really an impressive showing at Brown, 73-40 victory. Finished that back-to-back strong after winning by just single digits over Brown 8 days prior. Game of the weekend, really probably on both sides, Columbia and Cornell going to overtime up in Ithaca. Cornell pulling out the three-point victory that it really needed to have in the race for the Ivy League tournament. Harvard, 49 win over Dartmouth at Leviades. Rob, any standout moments or takeaways from the weekend that was on the women's side?
The Cornell Columbia game was fantastic. Those are two really good teams. They may not be at the top of the Ivy League, but they are really close, and they have gotten so much better. Columbia has been dominating the fourth quarter lately, and they were up 7 with 3 minutes to go, and somehow Cornell cobbled together 7 points to end up forcing it into overtime. And the two of them were just, matching bucket for bucket. It was incredible. And what was amazing, fast-paced again. I thought Cornell would slow it down, but so there were a lot of turnovers from both teams, but Cornell, which is not, free throws are not, and I know, incarnated Yale up into the upper echelons over the last few weeks, but heading into this weekend where they've got to go to Columbia and Cornell, that's a hard weekend now. I mean, those teams will pound the living daylights at both offensively and defensively. So I was, you can tell, I was really excited and enthusiastic about that game. Past years, Yale, even though they've had the better team, have found a way to end up 1-1 after that week, those two weekends. And so I think it was a really important thing. I know the players said how big it was after the first game about Brown, where they left them to really make sure that didn't happen again. So I think they must have been really pleased with the way they played and set them up well for this weekend. Harvard-Dartmouth, I think that was more of the game we kind of expected between those two. Harvard 11 for 24 from three-point land, 13 through 15 from the free throw line. Really, really nice effort from them. They played strong defense. Dartmouth did get 7 three-pointers, but it wasn't 13 like the first week, and they held them to 34% from two. So they even though they only had one forward, Harvard really, really did a nice job of protecting the rim. So I think a big split for them, a big split for Columbia, for Cornell as well. Again, like the men with Columbia, I think that's going to be something that's going to haunt the women as the season. but I mean, Temple, yeah, you know, if Penn can get Alea Parker back to last year, that's going to be super important as they move into this weekend.
Yeah, it was a terrific performance from Alea Parker. Yeah. I mean, you talked about Abby Hsu, and you know, when you think of her and Kayla Padilla and Shannon Mulroy, and you think that's a lot of great first year talent there.
they've reloaded. The league's reloaded. That's for sure.
Yeah, it's exciting stuff. Looking ahead to this weekend, on staying on the women's side, Brown will travel to, you know, we're now in full back-to-back mode. Interesting that the league went ahead with its announcement that it was reducing back-to-backs on the on the eve of the first back-to-back of the season, full back-to-back. Friday action, Brown will travel to Cornell, Princeton to Dartmouth, Yale at Columbia. As you noted, Rob, that's a very intriguing matchup there. And so is Penn at Harvard simultaneously Friday night. I mean, when you look at Penn and Harvard, I feel like Harvard has been, you know, not much buzz around Harvard, and maybe that's the way they like it. Still, I mean, we're talking about a top three defense in the league with Harvard. They play very stout defensively. That's been even more of their, you know, that's been more of their identity this year, is getting it done at the relying on defense, and it's worked. They they crashed the boards, particularly at the offensive end. I think it'll be Penn at Harvard strikes me as a very very intriguing, fairly even matchup. Yale at Columbia, you know, what can you say? As you said, Rob, Columbia had been finishing games well, so much firepower on that team, an awful lot of talent at both ends of the floor will be colliding at Levian at 7 o'clock Friday night. Any other thoughts, Rob, on those matchups?
Yeah, you know, I guess I'll start at the top, you know, with the number one team, 13-1 Princeton, unfortunately falling out of the top 25, basically because they've been inactive for the last few weeks. They've kind of struggled coming out of the break the last few years. I believe 2 years ago they lost at Yale. Last year they beat Columbia, but Bella Allery needed to score 45 points at an Ivy League record to secure that. So, you know, it's always a big question mark coming out of those 3 weeks, but, you know, and especially, you know, going on the road. So I do think that they have a favorable matchup with Dartmouth. That's a team that they should be able to beat, even if they're not playing at their top. But as long as, you know, Bella Allery and Carly Littlefield are healthy, which, you know, with 3 weeks of rest, I'm assuming they are. I haven't heard any opposite. They should have a good run this weekend. I think even with Harvard's improved defense, I think if Princeton, you know, gets that first game under their belt, I don't see a reason why they won't sweep the weekend. Looking at Penn Harvard, yeah, I think you're right. There's a solid matchup there. Jeannie Baim against Leia Parker, Lola Mullaney against Kayla Padilla. You know, you've got they're very equal. I do think that Penn has a stronger, I guess, rotation, if you will. I think they have a little bit more depth. Maybe Sturba, Kemba Grisella, you know, I think they've got good point guards, good 3-point shooting. Tori Crawford's going to come off the bench. I think she's a little stronger than Rachel Levy. So Penn and Harvard had two really great games in the regular season last year. Both went to overtime. Penn blew Harvard out in the Ivy tournament, but both rosters are pretty different this year. It'd be a tough game, but I think Penn will have a bit of an edge. Boy, Columbia, Cornell, Yale. Take your pick. You know, if you look at the stats, I went on Her Hoop Stat. Those three teams are pretty comparable with most of their offensive and defensive stats. It's pretty amazing. So I think both Yale, Columbia, Friday, Yale, Cornell, those are two toss-up games. I think that could be where the back-to-back is difficult. You know, for Yale, they've got to play a tough game against Columbia, take the 4 or 5 hour ride up to Ithaca. That'd be really hard to do, even if they escaped Friday night with a win. If they sweep that weekend, that'll be incredibly impressive. You know, the two Brown games, I'm not sure. I really don't know. You know, Brown has played worse in league play the last couple years than in non-conference play, and Saturday didn't give you much hope for them going forward. Justine Graziano is a phenomenal talent, but they don't have a lot beyond that. So I don't know. I think that's going to be an area where teams are going to have to make hay when they play Brown. So that's kind of where I see things this weekend. I guess Penn Dartmouth on Saturday. I think Penn is a little bit stronger team, so I think they'll come away victorious on that one.
And just to bookend that Saturday action, of course, as you noted, Penn will travel to Dartmouth, Yale at Cornell, Brown at Columbia, Princeton at Harvard, in a very interesting matchup. All of those games, 5 o'clock tips. Men's side, it's the first game will be Harvard at Penn. That's a 5 o'clock tip on ESPNU. Penn will be looking to avoid a fourth 0-3 start to Ivy play in 5 seasons under Steve Donahue. Pretty remarkable, really, given all the success that they've had under him, that's even on the menu. Penn looking to avoid that hole. 7 o'clock tips, Dartmouth at Princeton, Columbia at Yale, Cornell at Brown. Might as well just add the Saturday games in, too. I think everybody knows who the travel partners are, but 1 7 o'clock tip, Cornell at Yale, preceded by 3 6 p.m. starts. Harvard at Princeton, that's definitely going to be a doozy. Dartmouth at Penn, Columbia at Brown. Rob, what are your thoughts on that slate?
Boy, you know, for Penn and Harvard, you know, as you said, it's vital that they go 1-1 this weekend. It seems like we say this every year around this time. But I think, you know, beating Dartmouth is an absolute must. You know, for future tiebreakers down as the season progresses, they've got to beat the teams they should beat. Harvard, I think they're a 1-point favorite on KenPom. You know what? Even without Bryce, I mean, with Bryce Aiken, I think it's certainly, you know, Harvard will win that game. Without him, I still think Harvard has a favorable chance. You know, they're just so deep. You know, Chris Lewis and AJ Broder will probably battle all night long. You know, you've got Bentley, Goodman, you've got a lot of seniors on the court. You know, it's a lot of experience. People have played at the Palestra from Harvard, so they're not going to be intimidated by the environment. But what concerns me from Penn is you got Max Martz playing against Robert Baker, Durchett, you know, you. Bassey's now starting to hit three-pointers. You're going to bring Ledlam in. There's just too much Harvard. You know, if one guy is not playing well, they just, you know, move him out and move somebody else in. Penn doesn't have that kind of depth. So they're going to need
a tremendous amount of production from their big four, Broder, Bentley, Goodman, Dingle. If they don't get that, it's going to be a tough night. Hopefully, the game against Temple really changed things. They forced Temple into 1-for-13 from three. They're going to need that because Harvard's a pretty solid three-point shooting team, especially so far in league play. They've done really well. Harvard having the better offense, defense, and depth. I guess the only worry you've got if you're Harvard, again, is what happens when 5 minutes left in the game. You know, who holds on to that ball? Who shoots free throws for you? If they can finally figure that out, then they're in good shape. Let's see. I guess that would make Dartmouth, Princeton. Princeton obviously having some rust, even with the D3 game under their belt last weekend. I think they're just in a really good position. Richard Arrigouzo, you know, he may be battling with you know, Chris Knight. That'll be a really great matchup. But I don't think anyone has a matchup for Jalen Llewellyn and Schwieger. You know, Aaron Rye is playing super well and is like a very Princeton-like player. But I just think Princeton has more depth. Dartmouth seems to have a tough time stringing together 40 solid minutes, and I think, you know, Princeton at home want to build on those two games against Penn. I think they're in a really good spot for Friday night's game. Let's see. You're saying Yale has, who does Yale have? Cornell or Columbia? They have Columbia. Even they're at home. They're so much stronger than Columbia. And, you know, if the Columbia that showed up at Cornell the other day is there, it's going to be an ugly game. However, I probably said the same thing last year, and Columbia turned around and just blew Yale out of the JLA. So, you know, go figure. I think this is going to be a really good weekend for Brown. At least I hope for their sake it is. Then we're going to go to the other Saturday night, Harvard Princeton. You said it right. That's going to be some game. I think they match up well I think Princeton matches up well with Harvard. I think it's the kind of game that if Harvard has their late game troubles, I think Penn, they'll be able to get through Penn, but I don't know if they can get through a Jadwin. I really don't. That'll be a tough matchup. And then what's that? Penn Dartmouth. Again, Penn has to have that game, and I think they match up very well. I think they're built very similarly, Penn being at home. I think they're going to, that's a game I think they'll definitely take. So I don't expect an 0-4 start for Penn. I see either 2-2 or 1-3 at the end of this weekend.
Yeah, it is imperative, excuse me, that Brown take care of business for sure. They haven't swept Columbia and Cornell at home in quite some time. You know, I think you'd have to go back to 2014, the last time that Brown swept both of those at home. And, you know, last season, really a pivotal loss to Columbia at home in the next to last weekend of the season to help open the door for Penn to edge them out of the Ivy League tournament. That'll be very pivotal for Brown. Some interesting matchups there. Certainly Columbia traveling to Yale last season and building an 18-point lead in the second half there. One of the more stunning moments in conference play that I can remember. If they can replicate that, you know, that would be perhaps even more impressive, especially since I don't think Yale will be in any way sleeping on them. Just show them the film of last year's game and JLA and see what happens. It'll be interesting to see how much rust Princeton has. You know, this is the last season that they're going to have to deal with that. But it's not something new for the program. These games, just under a week after that win over Rutgers Camden. Penn, of course, struggled mightily against Dartmouth at the Palestra last season. Took overtime for Penn to get that win down the stretch. Yeah, I agree with you that it's not the end of the world if Penn splits. The more likely split would seem, of course, to be losing to Harvard and then holding serve against Dartmouth on the second night of a back-to-back at home. But you know, we'll see how things go. You know, last season, obviously, a challenge for Penn to get it done at the Palestra against Dartmouth. Chris Knight had a terrific game in that one, 25 points. You know, showed what he could do. Of course, so did AJ Broder. So AJ Broder had 36. Yeah, we'll see. I mean, hopefully the defensive effort against Temple is a harbinger of good things to come. It is worth noting, though, that the Owls are really not a good shooting team at all. And that it's not like that 1-for-13 performance from deep against Penn was, you know, terribly uncharacteristic. Maybe you know, obviously at the lower end of what they're capable of, but not you know, this was not like a hot shooting team or a team like Arizona that right. You know, instant offense.
You know, and there was also the fact that Penn was up, I think, 15 with just a couple. You know, we talk about Harvard having those late game struggles. You know, Penn was up 15 with just a few minutes to go, and Temple pressed and at the free throw line, especially the freshmen, and they really, really had a hard time. And I'm not sure if it was 5 or 6 points, you know, close to the end of the game, but you know, Penn's got to do a better job, especially if they're going to put three freshmen out there in their you know, front six or seven. So that's something to keep an eye out in those close games.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, and there should be some close games. You know, we're starting. You know, we're just now starting to get into the nitty gritty of the schedule, and it's worth noting that last season, the Ivy League led all of Division I in close game percentage. Games decided by fewer than 4 points, 3 points or less, or in overtime. 20 out of 56 regular season conference games, just under 36%, fit that category, which, if you think about it, I mean, you know, nearly 4 in every 10 games ending in by a possession or an overtime. And it certainly felt like it. I'd be by the end of the season, you kind of felt like, you know, this is going to happen every game. You just felt like it was going to come down to the wire. And that was the case as well the season before. The league led Division I in close game percentage. I think it's the last two seasons. Yeah. So, I mean, it could be a three-peat. I think the parity does seem to be there to provide it. So let's hope we get that.
So I'm curious, what's your take on the game of the week, potentially Harvard and Princeton?
That's a good matchup. You know, like I said, Princeton, it's always a bit of a wild card how much rust there is. But What's intriguing about the matchup is, you know, I always try to look at tempo, and, you know, Princeton playing a little bit faster this year, not much, But Harvard likes to keep the pace going, keep the pace up. So battle of tempo will certainly be interesting. You know, down low, you know, you look at Chris Lewis versus Richmond Ariraguzo. You know, that's a matchup where early foul trouble could conceivably swing a game. I don't think Princeton certainly doesn't have the depth that Harvard does, the depth that you noted. But you know, how will Harvard be able to handle, you know, Ryan Schwieger posting up? I mean, does Justin Bassey get in there to try to shut that down, or how does Harvard play that? That will be interesting. You know, Penn kind of gave them a blueprint of what not to do in the first game, and then we saw how Princeton reacted when Penn committed to trying to take away the inside game. So, you know, Tommy Amaker and his staff have both outcomes to break down. So, you know, that'll be an interesting game. I don't know. I'd have to look up, you know, try to bring it up here real quick. I guess Princeton. Ken Palm's predicting a 60% going toward Harvard, 3-point loss for Princeton at home, apparently. You know, we'll see. I mean, that sounds about right to me. But, you know, I can certainly see that game going either way. The Tigers have been very efficient at getting what they want inside, really not all season long. For the most part, not just against Penn. So, you know, it'll be up to a Harvard defense that is pretty strong, as it always seems to be under Amaker, and especially inside, to try to shut that down. Did we miss anything?
Well, I'll just throw a couple quick things out there, and something that you linked to on the Twitter feed. You know, a year ago at this time, we were talking about Devin Kennedy from Princeton, the senior, one of the all-time leading scorers. He had an altercation with local police, with campus police. He ended up being suspended. There were a whole big problems. He took time off from the university, and his season ended sporadically. It was a very chaotic couple months there for him, but he ended his season early. He's lighting it up for the Long Island Nets of the G League. He's averaging 14 points a game, 4 rebounds, 3 assists. But probably more important is he appears to have taken classes and finished his degree and will be graduating in the spring. The other thing I would just say is if you go to the Yale Daily News, there's a really interesting article by William McCormack, who does a phenomenal job covering the Bulldogs, the men's team. He is writing about the fact that Yale is one of the nation's premier programs, actually, at this point, if you look over the last 4 or 5 years, yet the fan support is not there. They are last in the league with 914 people per game. It seems like they'll sell out well against Harvard, but they struggle to get other people in the stands for the other games. So if you're a Yale fan, is one of our great writers, go to the game. You know, when the JLA is filled, it's a fantastic atmosphere. It's a great piece of college history, just being in that building. You really have one of the best programs in the country, one of the best coaches. He keeps reloading year after year. You know, I know there's a lot of stuff to do in New Haven and in Yale's campus, but, you know, going to a basketball game is just a couple hours out of your night or your afternoon, and it's well worth it. And I say that's across the board. Brown did a great job last week filling the Pensacola Center, but, like, you know, got to keep it up and Columbia, Cornell, you know, you got to have more fan support. So, you know, just realize the great stuff that's out there week after week. And it's for students especially, it's free. Go, enjoy. Can't push it more than that.
Yeah, and that's the challenge. And I know that that was attendance was something that always got a lot of scrutiny at Penn. Decline in attendance and increased student apathy over the years. You know, there's just a lot to do. So I definitely get that. There's a lot to do on campus. There's a lot to get done every night with academic obligations, social obligations, extracurriculars. You know, there's a lot to get done, but yeah, I mean, certainly anyone who isn't aware of what's going on with James Jones's program on campus or Allison Guth's, you know, is definitely missing out for sure. I did wanna note something that I wasn't able to squeeze in last week's podcast. Laura Bagwell Katalinich was selected recently as one of 30 candidates for the 2019-20 Senior Class Award in women's basketball, and she's certainly. Certainly very deserving of that. 3.934 cumulative GPA as a communication major, business minor. She's apparently been prominently involved in the team impact that Cornell has been involved in, you know, Karina Hill being a teammate, adopted as a teammate by the program, having been diagnosed with cerebral palsy in 2012. Bagwell Katalinich helped to coordinate her adoption and line up interactions between Hill and the team to make her feel included and welcome. She's been involved with Cornell Red Key, a program that does good work. You know, and obviously it's hard to keep that good of a GPA, all the while, you know, being one of the standouts of Ivy League basketball.
And she also transferred from Penn, so, you know, there's certain challenges that, you know, adapting to one school and then changing completely, you know, a following year. So that provides its own struggles.
Absolutely. So given all of that, yeah, I mean, that's great to see her nominated and really have earned all the recognition and that she gets for that. Just one of many athletes, Ivy League student athlete that does that, that goes above and beyond and contributes in ways that you can't really guess from watching a basketball game. So kudos to her and all those that and that seems like a good note to end on for Inside Ivy Hoops. That is really what it's all about, and that's what makes college basketball special at its best. Thanks so much for coming on, Rob. Appreciate it as always.
Oh, thank you as always, Mike. I always appreciate everything you bring to the website, to the podcast, and all the great insights you provide offline as well.
Well, happy to do so. Likewise, thank you for everything, Rob. Inside Ivy Hoops, hope you can tune in again next week. So long.